Hello, and welcome to the Cyber Sisters podcast. We're your Cyber Sisters, Allison and Emily, two cyber educators talking about edtech pedagogy, and this week, instructional coaching. Snyder has taught students ELA of various courses for 22 years, and for part of that time worked as a part-time building-based instructional coach. He transitioned to an educational consultant role 8 years ago. He supports and mentors teachers and coaches striving to increase student achievement and improve classroom practices through technology and blended learning. He's also a regional liaison for CDTs. In 2007, he was one of 100 educators in PA recognized as a Keystone Star for his innovative classroom practices with technology. He is a lifetime member of PAECT, PA's ISTE affiliate, actively volunteering in the organization as a Keystone Program Chair. You can find him occasionally tweeting on Twitter from @thespian70. Scott, welcome to the show. We're so excited to have you.
Well, I'm excited to be here. Thank you both to Allison and Emily for having me today.
I think it's going to be a really fascinating conversation. Now, as listeners of the program know, we are often shouting out KTI, ISTE, and PAECT as part of our own journey. So you are well within in your family here, Scott, today, talking with all of our listeners. Before we get started talking about instructional coaching, though, which is really what you're here for, as all of our listeners know, both Emily and I transitioned into instructional coaching roles. And it's been really fascinating, I think, this year for us to see education from this new side. And I also think that there's many, many teacher educators out there who are sort of acting in a similar role, though maybe they don't have quite the same name. They're those building level experts. There's those more veteran teachers who are mentoring teachers sort of underneath them in terms of years or skill. And so I thought that this would be a really good opportunity for us to learn from someone who is such a master, but also for them to sort of pick up some important skills that might be applicable both in their classrooms and inside of their buildings. But before we really jump into that, I'd love to spend some time talking a little bit about your journey as an educator and what brought you to teaching.
More than 30 years ago now, I was, 34 years ago, 35 years ago, I guess, I was getting out of high school. And I was, for a long time, I was kind of thought I was interested in the medical field. I'd done a division of Boy Scouts called the Explorers Program, which was co-gender, boys, girls, the whole nine yards, and had spent a good number of years there exploring different aspects of the medical field, had learned some basics like, taking learn how to take somebody's pulse with the stethoscope and putting fingers on the wrist and the whole cliche thing that you see nurses doing on medical TV shows and stuff like that. And I thought that's really where I wanted to go, the direction, and so much so that was kind of my focus in all of my college visits, looking for that perfect fit pre-med school in all of my travels. But I was also from ninth grade and then through high school, very involved with the theater program at my high school in Northwest Ohio, at Findlay High School. And I was kind of the one constant and where I'd finally found a group of friends that I gelled with, that we hung out. A lot of them I'd consider close friends and several I'm still in touch with from time to time. And had a unique program in Findlay at the time that allowed me to take a class my senior year where I got into selecting and then casting and then rehearsing and putting up a one-act play for a public showcase. So it was a class, but it was also extracurricular. I put time in the planning during the day, and then after school we would get together and my cast would get together in a room in the high school or on the stage and rehearse and try to get the show ready for production. And it was during that process, and this is getting very late in my senior year. It was late April, early May. I kind of realized that I really was enjoying the process of educating on the acting process, educating on working with kids, my own age group, but working with others to try to grow, learn new things, and to accomplish something in this platform. I kind of realized that there was needed to be a change in my thinking about what I wanted to do next. So I took a late visit to One of the state university systems, Bowling Green State University in Bowling Green, Ohio, that was originally founded as a teacher education school. It'd be like the equivalent of Shippensburg here in the Commonwealth, and decided I was going to go there and pursue an education degree. But kind of resolutely held on to this idea that it needed to be in the maths and the sciences. Actually declared as a math ed major my first semester of college. I attempted to get through Calc 2, and I just couldn't deal with the theory behind it and how it was going to apply and how I was going to connect high school kids with that. Or math and secondary kids with math in general. So I made a move to chemistry ed for a semester, and I had to take a chemistry class anyhow for general ed credit, and learned that I really loved playing in the lab, but I didn't like the theory so much. And finally came to terms with the fact that I belonged someplace in ELA and got into a really unique program that I don't even know that exists, a degree program that exists in Ohio anymore. And I've never heard anybody else say anything about it, where I actually got a degree in communications education, which certified me to be a public speaking teacher, came away with a public speaking minor. An ELA background to teach English classes at the secondary level, and a pretty strong theater background, which I hoped to leverage all of the work that I did in either working on a yearbook or working on directing, getting into a theater program at a school or something like that. So that was kind of my journey through everything to get to my degree at the very least.
What I love about that is that you had this moment, right? And it's interesting how many educators who went and sort of were like, I'm going to do something else, and sort of had very much an intention with that, usually had some other touchstone with their subject area much earlier in their life. And so with you in that play, to then sort of come back and be like, you know, it was a play that we were doing, and yes, it was the feedback, and yes, it was sort of the teaching and the manning of all the different pieces. But it was also the literature, right? Like it there was that touchstone for you there from the very, very beginning. And I find it so important for especially some of the listeners that we have who are younger. We do have some listeners who are, you know, in high school or even in those early college years, just to hear from people who are very successful in their profession that it is 100% okay to not, you know exactly what you're going to do, that your career is going to take all sorts of lefts and rights, and that is completely fine. Speaking of lefts and rights, how did you transition sort of that role from, you know, ELA, being in the classroom, into the sort of more coaching and instructional coaching role?
I'm trying to remember exactly how this one happened, you know, because once you get into as most people know, once you get into the throes of a classroom, sometimes it just feels like you're on a 9-month grind where you're just trying to keep your head above water at times.
Truest. Very true.
But at some point, you know, I kind of realized that there was another challenge out there. I'd been teaching for probably about 15 years at that point in time, someplace in the 10 to 15 year range. 2007, there was a program here in Pennsylvania called Classrooms for the Future. And it was that work, the work with that kind of awakened my eyes to that there was some room for growth. I had always kind of been one that liked to use technology with my kids in the classroom. Like I was willing to go to the computer lab and take the time to, you know, word process the articles, but we were attempting to do other things in the computer lab too, at the time, as much as we could and as much as time as I could get in the computer lab, because everybody was kind of vying for that time, you know, to type up lab reports or type up essays and things like that. So when Classrooms for the Future kind of rolled around, and brought technology in on all kinds of levels, I realized there was a lot that we could do. And yet there were so many of my peers who I respected a great deal that we weren't moving the needle to engage kids with this new platforms were coming in to our buildings. You know, we suddenly had laptop carts that could go every place. in the building that had the capability to record audio podcasts like this, that we had video cameras that we brought in that we could go send the kids out in the building to record video and record skits or record reflections and then put them together and edit them like a small movie. I was in an Apple school, so we used iMovie a lot for that. And then there were others that we were just not doing that. And there were others that were struggling with their engagement of kids in the classroom. And I kind of had overcome that over a good number of the early years in my career, where I wasn't sure I was cut out to even be a classroom teacher, where I was struggling with the kids, and how to connect with them. And once I just kind of became myself, I made that connection, and I'd hope that, some other new teachers coming down into the system, I could work with them too to do that. So it was kind of a two-pronged approach there too. I was interested in helping them with the technology in the classroom, but also interested in helping them improve basic classroom practice, you know, help engage kids so that we give kids the best experience that they could possibly have.
One thing that I think in my own experience moving into coaching that I believe much more strongly than I ever have before is that teaching is a science and an art. And so it is so important. I know as we get further into this episode, we're going to talk a lot about the qualities necessary for an instructional coach to really make a change and to make a difference and to be there to support a teacher. But I think that point that you made about being yourself and giving yourself permission to be yourself, that cannot be overstated. Kids can smell a lack of authenticity a mile away. They know. If you're acting sort of out of something that you feel like you have to do. And so if you want to get authenticity and effort and engagement out of your students, it's got to start with authenticity and openness and effort from you, right? To set that tone as a teacher leader.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more with that, that, you know, it could just kind of have to be you. And when one of my colleagues pointed out to me, you know, as I started to make that transition to my classroom practice, I needed to make that transition to my classroom practice. One of my colleagues, a chemistry teacher of all people, her name was Joanne Glossner, said to me, "Scott, why don't you act more like you do with your theater kids, with your regular kids in your classroom?" And I just needed somebody to say that to me, and it clicked. And I would credit her partly with starting to send me down this path that eventually put me into the coaching path in my building. For a short period of time, and then kind of seeking or applying for this opportunity when it was not directly presented to me, but when I became aware that it was out here at the my current employ.
So as we're talking about this, for listeners who maybe don't have an instructional coach at their school, or I know I was talking to somebody the other day, it might have been yesterday, I can't remember. We were talking about how sometimes people say, what is an instructional coach supposed to do? Because even if you have one in your building, maybe the role is a little muddy. So what exactly is instructional coaching for people who might not be aware?
Okay. So I guess my initial answer is always, you know, a coach works with teachers to reflect on classroom practices, all with the aim of growing and improving student achievement. But I would also kind of put in this context that, I've talked with the local coaches to Intermediate Unit 15 Capital Area IU from time to time about how a coach, I think coach is a good word. It's like any other coach. Kids seek out coaches either through teams or for individual coaching when they want to improve their practice. Kids seek out a musician coach. We call them musical teachers, or people that give the lessons when they want to improve their musical practice, be it guitar or piano or anything like that. And so why don't we embrace the same thing in education? I think that concept I would hope that at some point in time, people would open themselves to this idea more readily than they do right now, that it's okay to have a coach that will help you tweak those things that you're already doing to make them a little bit better, like people do in all these other, like athletes do, like musicians do, like so many people do in their professional practice.
I heard a fabulous quote yesterday that was, every teacher needs a coach.
Yes.
I wrote that one down.
I definitely think that when we look at sort of coaching, I think teachers struggle with the idea of letting someone into their classroom, right? And the classroom is such a personal space. And as a teacher, I've often said to many of my friends who are outside sort of the educational role, you have to wear so many hats. You're responsible for so many decisions that all are connected to one another. And so classrooms are these little biomes, these little microcosms. And I do think that thinking of it that way has sort of helped me in imagining why I'm sometimes getting resistance when I go in for like a really simple walkthrough, right? Like I'm just here to observe. I'm just here to learn. Especially in the beginning, before you've built that trust with a teacher, right? You're going to feel that resistance. You're going to feel a certain amount of that sort of coming in. And that framework has really been very helpful for me, is to think of it like this teacher has created an ecosystem. And when a new element gets introduced to an ecosystem, there's a fear that something might go wrong, right? Whether it's a new piece of technology or a new person, or that they may not understand the intricacies of that experience. And so I definitely think there's legitimate reason for teachers to sort of sometimes be concerned about entering people into their practice. So when you're sort of in that role there, Scott, thinking about you know, how to best incorporate yourself into a classroom, how to build that relationship as a coach. What are some of the things that you think are most important in order to drive that relationship? What are the qualities that you really need as a coach? And what are some of the approaches that you've seen work really well in this environment?
I think very definitely. You approach the whole situation around kids. Because I would be hard pressed to find any educator that says that they're not there for the kids.
Absolutely true.
Yeah. So we have to, we look at this through that lens that what would you like? I mean, it's a conversation. Everything's a conversation when it comes to coaching. And I think one of those conversations is, what's something in your classroom that you wish could be a little bit better, so it would benefit the kids just a little bit more. And starting at that point and kind of fleshing out where they want to go. It's not about the coach's ideas, about preconceived ideas about what might be wrong in the classroom when they step in. It shouldn't be about an administrator's ideas about what's wrong in a classroom and them telling the coach to go fix this for the teacher, with a teacher. When they get to that point, it should be about the teacher arriving at a conclusion of some sort about what they want to improve in their practice.
Empowerment. It's empowerment.
Yeah, absolutely. And when that transaction takes place, people become a little bit more accepting, because it's about growing the kids at that point in time. And then you can have conversations about, and you can collect data and have conversations about, and I know a lot of people have really negative connotations about the word data these days, but, you know, it can be what kids do, how often kids do things in the classroom. I'm not talking test data necessarily, although it can be part of the equation. But just kind of taking snapshots of what's going on in the classroom and saying, okay, well, we expected this to happen. Here's the reality of what happened. How would you like to tweak this so we can get to what you hoped would be your ideal? And again, just letting the teacher make some instructional decisions, whether or not you agree with them, number one, and whether or not you know they're, I mean, even if you know that it's the approach they want to take is doomed to fail, you've got to let them go down that path, venture down that path, and let them see for themselves. And maybe they've got a brilliant idea for how to approach something that will work great because of the teacher's demeanor, the way teachers connect with the kids or something like that. So you just kind of have to let those things play out.
One of the things that I most appreciated, and Emily, you probably remember this because we were all at Pete together. Emily and I are about to record our sort of follow-up from Pete episode that sort of is next in our season. But Scott did a really great, I'm at a pre-event, sort of a pre-con event that we were at, a sort of speech about this sort of dirtiest words in education, and the sort of punchline at the end for Scott there was that data was the one that really was the most problematic. So since you've sort of opened that door for me, I'd love for you to just chat a little bit about that too. So why do you feel that data is such a tough word for many teachers to get behind these days?
I'll kind of try to remember some of the words I used there when you saw me. But, I think a lot of the reasons why data has become such a tough word to swallow for educators these days is because data is usually associated with the big things, PSSAs, Keystones, even PSATs, SATs, ACT scores, AP scores. And it does a lot of things happen with those numbers. It siloizes kids into certain tracks when they're given achievement tests, that it may, because of the way teachers or administrators think, cut off learning opportunities for them, or because they need remediation or something like that. It siloizes schools, like when we even talk about, because of those numbers of PSSAs and Keystones play into things like PVAS schools and school ready indexes and things like that. When we're not pitting schools against each other, trying to compete to make sure they're not on the watch list. Because schools that aren't on the watch list, you're going to have people that want to move into your district and bring their kids there for you. And it's really not what I think we should be about right now, because there's a lot of good data out there that we can use to help improve the lot of kids and that we can use to help kids grow at the best and the biggest gains that we can possibly give them in the setting through things like formative assessments. That's data. But I think that's kind of gotten drowned out by these bigger picture things that the politicians and the departments of education and the superintendents and the curriculum directors kind of focus on those big picture numbers. There's all those formative assessment pieces of data. There's those minute to minute data gathering that a teacher's doing to decide, do I keep doing this in the classroom? Do I need to stop and tweak this lesson on the spot because it's just not working for the kids? That kind of stuff. So I think we should be embracing data. And that's kind of how I ended that 10-minute talk that I did at the Keystones pre-conference event at PTC.
I truly laughed so hard. I mean, it was such a good speech. The entire thing was so well done. And I really did leave sort of thinking very differently about what is data. And it really is anything that we can collect. There's a teacher that I've been working with in sort of one of my capacities, not a formal impact cycle, but just sort of helping on the side. And at one point we were looking at a recording, and I just started ticking off how often I saw students laughing, how often I saw them sort of giving some sort of positive engagement and gave a laugh score at the end. This was a great moment for this teacher, you know what I mean? To see, that this kind of engagement that you're looking for isn't quite there, but there's this other kind of engagement that you're really getting. How can we use those two things to kind of bridge? Teachers are out there thinking like, ah, yes, my laugh score, something that really, matters to be recorded, but right. It's all about what you find. And I think that there's a wide variety of types of data that we can collect, reasons to collect data, context for the data. And I think starting with that why is so important in that buy-in for what you're taking a look at. So
I think you hit on something, because I think the other thing about data too, is that it's been so weaponized by sometimes even administration to pit teachers against teachers. I can think of one specific example that happened where they were like, we're just collecting this data. We're not going to use it to compare across the department. And then like two meetings later, what was there? A graph comparing all of our scores across the department. I think that is something too that teachers get nervous whenever they're asked for their data, because generally it's just give me your data and not why do you need this data?
Right. And Emily, and I agree that was probably not a well-handled situation, but there is a spot, I think, and I talk about this in some of my other work that I do outside coaching with the CDTs that I do, that there is that spot to take a look at data across classrooms. And I think you've got to do that some curricular reasons, especially when you're trying to think about how everything that's got to be covered in a classroom and how are there gaps that are being missed as kids change grades and move, especially buildings then too, because teachers don't get to talk to other teachers outside their grade band typically. You've got those three silos too. Elementary, middle, and high are the typical ones. Sometimes things get dropped and skills never get picked up or get taught and that are expected to be taught because they're testable content here in Pennsylvania on the PSSAs and the Keystones.
And I also think that what made that moment particularly difficult was the promise, right? Like if a promise gets made in one way, you've got to follow through, you know what I mean? And I think that's where one thing that I think inside of coaching, I am constantly trying to like keep notes of, right? Like, what did I promise to people? What did I say that I was going to do? Did I live up to that? Did I fulfill that? If a teacher came to me and said, there's something that I'm concerned about, that I need it to go this way. Am I honoring that? Am I making time for it? That follow through piece, you know, is so important in the same way that when we're working with our students, you know, they are so attuned to, you know, well, you said that we were going to do it this way, or you said that I could do this. And that flexibility sometimes that we wish we could have in the classroom to be like, oh, I know we said that, but we only have 10 minutes left in class, you know, and I need to finagle, you know, you gotta be a person of your word in a lot of those situations. But I agree that there's times where I think, especially if people are open to it, where looking at how did you handle something? How did I handle something? What were the results? And how are we centering students in that, I think, really helps. That's the other thing about sort of comparisons across, right? I'm sure, Emily, it felt in that moment like we weren't necessarily centering the students. We were centering the teachers with our comparison, right? How good a job did they do instead of how good a job did the students do in some different environments? And what can we learn from those environments? Because there's no such thing as like a bad job, right? If you tried something and it didn't work, that's neutral data, right? But it doesn't mean that you're a bad teacher because you tried something new and it didn't work, right? It's just that's information that you now have, but you're a good teacher for continuing to try and continuing to look at those results and continuing to center your students. So I think there's a lot of ways that we can sort of lighten those conversations and make them a lot healthier.
Yep, I totally agree.
So now that we've talked about the most important qualities to have, what are some qualities that might hold you back and or approaches to coaching that might be less effective?
Okay. So, you know, on the personal level, since you brought up qualities and approaches, and I'm not sure I talked approaches specifically the last time. So I'm going to provide, I'm going to start with the approaches, I think, because it would be, I think my people will pick up on what my answer would have been if I'd been direct about that. One of the detrimental effects of that can bring down a coaching program is having no systematic approach to coaching. So conversely, I would argue that there needs to be a systematic approach. And by that, I mean that, you know, a coach's role needs to be heralded, it needs to be laid out, needs to be exalted from the top down. And you know, that's got negative connotations to it too, when you things are top down. But what I mean by that is, you know, the superintendent, the district administration, the building administration, they all have to have a vision of coaching and what it's going to be. And when everybody's not driving, pushing for coaching to be moving in the same direction, coaching becomes muddied. Coaching can't be necessarily move in a direction because it doesn't have a direction to move in. A building principal may think he knows what is the best thing to do with coaches, but it may not be the best use of the coach's time or efforts to do those things. And it's in situations like that when coaching is not clearly defined that coaches get pulled aside to be an administrative assistant, to help do paperwork in the office, to do clerical work in the office, to get testing packets ready for the PSSA or some other kind of diagnostic testing that happens in some of the grade levels. Or even a worst case scenario, I think, is being the first line of defense when there's not enough subs in the building. because if they're called and they feel like they have to say yes in that situation, they're going to cancel a coaching situation that they may have set up, a coaching event that they've got set up. And then that damages the relationship between the coach and the teacher. So there's a lot of ancillary effects when that when an approach is not definitively set for what coaching is going to be in a school, or I think really ideally in a district, minimally at the school level, that it's clear and it's often articulated. And by that, I mean like beginning of the year, maybe even, it might seem crazy, but at the middle of the year, remind everybody what the coach is there for and what they're going to do. And what their role is to be, and then reboot that again at the beginning of next year. Not when I say reboot, not redefine, but just remind everybody that they, hey, so and so is your coach, and here's what they are available. Here's what their work is going to entail. Individually, kind of specifically, quality wise, unsuccessful people are going to be the ones that kind of come into a coaching situation thinking they've got all the answers. They've got the only answers. They've got the right answers, and they're close-minded to any other approaches. Not being able to listen, not being able to ask questions that are going to cause their classroom teachers to be reflective, and those that try to nudge teachers in a certain direction because they think that's the right direction to go. Those are the ones that are going to kind of struggle a little bit with their coaching. And it takes some time for coaches to develop that habit. It's not something that's natural. It's not something that's there right away. I would even argue that just because you're the best classroom teacher doesn't necessarily mean you're going to be the best coach.
I think truer words have never been spoke. And I think that comes true in a lot of industries. So my boyfriend works in a very different field than I do. He works in insurance. And one of the things that we've had many a conversation about is how many times someone will get promoted into some sort of leadership role because they were very good at the work, but maybe were not very good at the leadership or the soft skills or the things that were necessary to be able to jump into that new position. Or they think that because they are in a position of leadership, their job is to like make a bunch of little thems, right? To kind of go back to our theme from the beginning of the episode, right? When really it's a completely different subset of skills. And so I don't think there's anybody who's a natural at coaching, right? Like I certainly am not a natural at coaching. I'm sure, you know, Emily wouldn't say that she's like the natural either. You know, these are all skills that take time to cultivate, and that are, you know, going to go through ups and downs, and mistakes are going to get made. I nary feel like I spend a day inside of coaching. Now I think I've been in this for like a hot second, like 5 months, where I don't look at something and say, ooh, you know what, I could have done that better, or I could have done X, Y, or Z better. Mm-hmm. But what one of the pieces that I think personally has been helpful for me is that reflection. And I imagine that you would probably agree with that ability to look at something, to reflect, and to be able to say, okay, you know, I'm not bad for making the choice that I made, you know, but here's, I can look at myself kind of objectively, or I can seek out the opinions of other people that I trust, other peers, other teachers even. You know, I have several teachers that I really trust to sort of give me the, you know, this meeting went great or this meeting didn't. Mm-hmm. to help you to locate yourself inside of a new skill.
Right. And it takes some time to develop too. I mean, I got to, when I was built a building based coach, I got 2.5 years to try to hone my skill, and I was not there yet. I'd be the first to admit, I only realized well after the fact how to handle one of the situations that always frustrated me and flummoxed me, and I guess kind of made me want to shut down. And that was when teachers thought everything was okay in their classroom, even when the data said otherwise. Mm-hmm. I just never knew what to do. I never figured out what to do. And that's just because I was inexperienced and I didn't get the time I needed to develop fully as a coach before finances in the district dictated we needed to make a change.
Do you ever feel like you answered that question for yourself? A young coach to a more experienced coach?
I think I could probably do it now. I mean, there's a lot to be said for the old cliche that with age comes wisdom. And here I am in year 30 of what's probably going to be a 35-year education career. And yeah, I probably would handle that a little differently now. I think in the heat of, I'll call it the heat of the moment, although it wasn't ever, I think, confrontational.
You are certainly not someone that I would ever describe as particularly confrontational. And in that, you have a very kind demeanor.
Some of my students would have disagree with that, but
so as we talk about new coaches, what are some resources that you would recommend for a new instructional coach?
Well, I think people new to coaching need to talk to other coaches, which is why a valuable part of the coaching program or the coaching program that used to be supported by the Department of Education involved the IU's supporting network meetings where coaches get together and talk to each other. So that's, and learn from each other. So that's one front. I think coaches need to collaborate with each other within a district. So hopefully you're not solo, you're not the only one. But in the event that you are, is to seek out and see if there is a network at your local intermediate unit or educational service agency for those of you listening from outside Pennsylvania. Because everybody probably has some kind of educational service agency. I'm kind of going down a rabbit hole here, but just so everybody kind of has a context for that. You know, in New York, they call them BOCES. And simply down in Texas, I forget, but there's a different term down in Texas that I had learned at one point in time. But it's always just a layer between the schools and between the departments of education to help convey or implement policy. Is really what these service agencies do. And that's what our service agency does. I can get more detail too, if you want me later, but back to the connection to coaching, you know, you need to seek out if there is a network of coaches there that you can connect with to see if there's some learning that you can go through and collaboratively learn with others so that you can deepen your understanding of coaching and how to approach different situations and how to do some of the things that you are asked to do as a coach. And barring those things not being there, I think the best thing you can do is to read. There are all kinds of great books out there on instructional coaching. One of the big ones right now that we're actually a number of the region's mentors to the Harrisburg area, and that's not fair to call them that because we're not all connected to Harrisburg, but IU's 11, 12, 13, 14, 15, and 29 have a collaborative, and we have focused this year on Jim Knight's definitive guide to instructional coaching, which is a result of his 15, 20 years plus work in coaching and the best practices that go in. But there's the Eisenbergs here in Pennsylvania as well, who have a 15-year history with coaching. You'll probably hear me clicking on my computer because I'm embarrassed to say that I have forgotten the title of their book that's fairly new that focuses on coaching as well and all the lessons from here in Pennsylvania for what it was. So, you know, to look at those, or you can look at Kate Sweeney or Elena Aguilar or any of the other numbers of people that have done some work on coaching, but those are some of the big names that really you should be thinking about taking a look at if you're kind of new to the coaching world, the coaching process here.
In many ways, it sounds very similar to the starting of a teaching practice, right? And that's, I think, one of the things that sort of Emily and I have done a lot of sort of off the podcast discussing about is that coaching is a practice the same way teaching is. It is something that you are continuously practicing and developing new things for. And the things that help you practice at any other skill, right, as you were sort of saying, Scott, will help you to do your practice here. So finding that community network, the thing that I was always looking for was to have somebody that is kind of at the same level as you, somebody who's starting. I have Emily who's sort of at that same level, and I have in my building another instructional coach that I work with very closely, who also sort of started at roughly the same time. So you have somebody who's there laterally, and then you have somebody who's in front of you. You have somebody who's been doing it for much longer and can sort of speak to you with that distance. But sometimes with distance comes forgetting some of the challenges that are in that day-to-day stuff. So you have to have both, right? You've got to have somebody who's out in front of you and somebody who's standing right beside you to help with that perspective. Mm-hmm. As you're sort of looking through that place. So that makes perfect sense to me, that you're sort of looking to find that community and also just to find models to emulate, right? Even if you don't end up, keeping like the entire practice. I have to say I'm a huge fan of Gym Night, and I've been enjoying moving through my first few impact cycles very much. But it is just like with music, you know, you start by imitating, you know, what a great singer sounds like, pretending mm-hmm. you are, Christina Aguilera, or, you know, showing my age when I pick some of these singers, right? I knew Emily would pick up on it. But that helps you to develop your own voice, right? Your own authentic self is sometimes by taking on that inflection or those skills of other people.
Right. And the great thing about all the approaches is, as I've done more and more reading about coaching, and I try to get in maybe a book a year on coaching that I find time to work in, is that they really all in one way or the other is really about the students in the classroom and approaching coaching from the student perspective. I've had some argue that certain approaches seem to be more teacher focused. And I think that's just a matter of presentation in their approach. But it really all comes back to the students and how can we grow them and what can we do in the classroom so that they get the best experience possible. And I do, and in all fairness to our Pennsylvania folks and our homegrown coaching initiative, Bruce and Ellen Eisenberg's book is the Instructional Coaching in Action book. So that's Instructional Coaching in Action. And it is a very worthwhile read as well for anybody new to the coaching coaching world as well.
Emily, added to the list. You guys know the drill by now.
I put it at the bottom. I will link that. I'll link Sweeney. I'll link Gym Night on the list to be linked in the resources.
Manages to type. You guys cannot possibly understand how quickly this girl types. Like you'll hear me talking quite a lot on the podcast. If we were a digital podcast, you would absolutely see Emily frenetically going through writing up these resources for people. And we'll be half an hour done this episode recording. I tell you, and she'll already have, you know, everything ready for me for my slow pokeness, doing all of the editing and fun stuff like that. She's so fast.
I do say that I take notes faster typing than I do writing. I was going to just say too, with our talking about this, that when I first started, and I still feel like this, I didn't even know the right questions to ask. So like to Allison's point about like having someone who's so far ahead of you that sometimes doesn't remember what it's like to be new. I totally had that problem because I didn't know the right questions to ask of my mentor. And then, like, I went through my first round of cycles, and then they were colossal failures. And I was talking to her, and I was like, well, how did you know to do that? How did you know to do that? And she's like, I just knew. And I didn't know the right questions to ask to set everything up correctly. So I think there's also, like, trying to find that sweet spot to figure out, I guess, how you know what you don't know.
Mm-hmm. And you may think you figured it out, and then all of a sudden that question doesn't work. That question you think is going to work for everybody with everybody doesn't work with somebody. And you're just going to have to, you know, keep it together for that short period of time and try to figure out if reflect and try to come up with another question that is going to get you to the point that you want to, the point that needs to drive the conversation forward. To be the reflective, to get the teacher to reflect on what you've just agreed, collaboratively agreed to focus on.
Well, and speaking of questions, and the right question, We do have a tradition for the end of our podcast, and I cannot even believe, I'm looking at the time for this, that we've been speaking for like well over 40 minutes. I feel like this time has just like completely flown by. So Scott, thank you for all of your expertise and your wisdom here. I just think you have so much to add on so many levels, from administrative to teacher level. And I do think there's a lot of value in sort of approaching a lot of teaching practice, I think, with this same spirit of being a coach, of, you know, trying to get someone to sort of open up, needing to be that listener, you know, that person who's there to sort of see from the outside and to support and to provide and to center, right? For the student, it might be centering their own learning, right? Instead of centering, you know, themselves or their ego, you know, as a student. Go ahead.
Well, I just had this thought before you go into the question.
Yeah.
That this actually goes back to how/why we originally started this podcast 4 seasons ago.
Absolutely.
Because we started this as peer coaching. And it started off as a coaching podcast and us going to find people. I was going to say our friends, because most of them were our friends and PAECT and KTI people, but
just happened to have very talented friends.
Yeah, we do have very talented friends. That's why we espouse the wonders of KTI and PAECT. And like, that's where this started. This just felt like a very full circle moment for me that I needed to share. Sorry.
No, I love that though. And I think that it's true in many respects, right? I think that's where like that first of you have to have somebody out in front and you have to have somebody beside, right? Like you were my person beside and we brought in different people in the front, right? And we're doing the same thing now sort of in our coaching practice. But the same is true, I think, in a classroom. And I think also that one of the really aha moments that I was sort of having here and sort of centering students, as we were talking, Scott, is how do we get a student to do that for themselves, right? How do we get them to have a person alongside and a person in front, right? That person in front is the teacher, that person alongside is the other student. And what is the thing that they're centering, right? Like they're centering, you know, their own learning or their work or, you know, the skill that they just performed or something like that, their data, right? To truly bring this podcast full circle, right? In some capacity. I think learning and growing and being able to share in the joys of learning and growing is something that takes place at every level of education, right? Like teachers are just professional learners and instructional coaches just like really double down on that, man. Mm-hmm. So to come back to our final question that we always end with, and thankfully this question, because it's open-ended enough, Scott, you can take this in any capacity that you like, whether it is education, whether it is coaching, whether it's some combination of both. It could be your sort of current roles working with PACT or the IU or any of these areas wherever it sort of fits, is to ask, what do you wish you knew before you got started? Once again, we have a lot of very young listeners who are sort of just starting their educational journey. And so for you to be able to take this moment to be that person out ahead, we'd love for you to share some advice.
Well, I think my answer, if you'd have asked me, you know, what's the thing I wish I knew when I started talking education, or if you'd have asked it, started coaching, I think the answer is the same for anybody approaching either of those situations, and that's just to be yourself. Once you're comfortable in your own skin, I think everything clicks. And for some of us, it takes a lot longer to get comfortable in our own classroom skin, in our own coaching skin, in that place where we are doing what we do. And I think I would even venture to admit that I've grown in my profession here at the IU. And I'm probably more myself now in what I do than I was when I initially started 8 years ago. But I think that's just the nature of switching jobs and switching roles. It's happened quicker each time I've undergone that transition, I feel. But I think it all comes back to getting comfortable in your own skin, surrounding yourself with people who are supportive of you, perhaps smarter than you, and willing to go on a ride with you, willing to go on a journey with you, and going on that journey together to wherever it takes you, wherever it goes. And those have been my best classroom. Once I got to that point, those points, those were my best classroom experiences, my best coaching experiences, my best professional learning experiences in this latest role that I've got here at the IU.
Well, with that in mind then, Scott, thank you for being a part of our ride and our journey today on this episode of the podcast. And thank you all, dear listeners, for also joining us on this ride, being a part of our journey on this episode of the Cyber Sisters podcast. Scott is on Twitter. At @thespian70. So if you're looking to get in touch about anything related to the episode, or if you listen and you just think, wow, what an amazingly smart person, I'm sure he is accepting praise. In the meantime, though, please keep in touch with us on our socials. We're on Twitter at @AllisonKTeaches and @SeidlerSober. And as always, we appreciate keeping that conversation going. So please like, comment, and subscribe wherever you get your podcast. And as always, keep trying hard.